are listening to
90.7 FM
WGXC
Acra.
Hudson Catskill.
WGXE welcomes audio responses and feedback from listeners. Anyone can call and leave a message and we'll play it on the air. Call area code 518-622-2598 and leave up to a 3-minute message for airplay. That number again is 518-622-2598.
Are you in love like me with radio station WGXE? We can't survive like bees on honey. Every 6 months, we need more money. The drive will go on for many more days or until $15,000 we raise. Oh, yes, please, please don't be late. Call 622-2598. When you have a radio, when you have a studio, you must pay rent. You can't run a radio station out of a tent. Air conditioning and heat eat up donations at both the Catskill and Acres locations. And whether you like Irish country or rap, some part of our money goes as fees to ASCAP. So you can see where we can't be sedate. Call us on the phone in area code 518. Hosts volunteering keep expenses down with the least expensive station in this town. Hosts come in weekly to do their shows in summer heat and in winter snows, and for an hour or two hold down the fort. So don't you call and give them support. Won't you call? And if we were a church, we'd be passing the plate. Call 622-2598. We wouldn't be looking for more if we had plenty, so please give us a 10 or 20. For our dilemma, there is only one solution, a tax-deductible contribution. To make donating not so hard, just give us the number of your credit card. We also take cash or personal checks. It will be used for everyday projects. So some old equipment we will update if you call 622-2598. If we don't get enough, we are out on a ledge. Please, please, don't you call and make a pledge. And tell all your neighbours and your friends to listen each day till the pledge drive ends. When the final total goes over the top, this year's pledge drive will come to a stop. So you see, it's important that you donate. Please call 622-2598. And that's in the 518 area code.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Sabisha Friedberg of Paris, France. WGXC supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Take your good evening. Off children. I'm Kevin Factor, and you're listening to Foraging Ahead. Tonight on Foraging Ahead, Aaron Morales. He is an extraordinary guitar player, an aspiring opera singer, a lawyer in his hometown of Managua, Nicaragua, and he's under 30 years old. Remarkable young man. Aaron's story in many ways begins 30 years before he was even born. In 1972, an earthquake devastated Managua, Nicaragua. It's the same earthquake that brought Roberto Clemente, the famed Pittsburgh Pirate right fielder, to charter a plane to bring relief. It's a plane that he died in. But that same earthquake also drove Aaron's father and his grandfather to come to America under very generous asylum rules, back when this country had generous asylum rules, to live for almost 20 years. His father then became a citizen. And even though Aaron was born in Managua, he retained American citizenship and took advantage of that to make his life in this country, in the Hudson Valley. Aaron had a partner, a musical partner, Emilio, who he brought over, and he had asylum as well. But these different times in this country, and the asylum that Emilio was given was rescinded. We're going to listen to music from their group, Duo Andalucía, and we're going to hear about Aaron's musical journey and his life in the United States, and also about his work as an attorney in Nicaragua, and a little look into the life and times of the people of Nicaragua from Aaron's point of view. First, Duo Andalucía.
An American citizen from Nicaragua. Interesting story.
So there was like a, I think it was in the 70s or 80s, there was like a big earthquake in Nicaragua, and apparently a lot of countries were assisting with asylum procedures because it destroyed the whole city. So my parents, So my parents decided to, I mean, my grandfather and my dad decided to bring their family, well, my family, I guess, to New York. My grandfather opened like he was doing car repairs and a lot of important stuff in Nicaragua for Mercedes. So he brought that knowledge here to open his garage in the city, New York City.
Where in the city,
I think it was in Queens. Yeah, so they stayed here for a lot of years, to a point that, well, my dad lived more than 20 years here, so he got the citizenship, you know, after a certain time. So when I was born, he kind of like transferred to me. And
but you were born in
Nicaragua. Yeah. The constitution over there allows you to have two different citizenships. So yeah, when the social political crisis came over there in 2018, yeah, I told my parents, hey, you know, taking advantage that I'm a citizen, I'm not going to wait for things to get fixed here, because no one ever knows. It's been 8 years and still didn't get fixed. So immediately after the issue started, that's why when I took advantage to come here and do something else. Yeah.
What were you doing in Nicaragua before you came here?
Music, and I was studying law. I actually finished law over there. I'm a lawyer in Nicaragua.
Is that right?
Yeah. I can show you my degree. Yeah, but like here, the only thing I didn't pursue the opportunity of like doing law was because, unlike Nicaragua, that you can practice law in the whole country, like here, if you are a lawyer in Florida, and then I decided to move to New York, I got to study all over, you know, or like at least there's like 7, 8 different states that allow you to do the bar exam without studying. But the thing of like going through academic loans and all that, and reading a lot about how people that do actually get a degree not always make more money than people that don't have a degree. So that's when I started like getting more into like business management, customer service. I was manager for a couple years from like GM on restaurants over there in Miami. While I was also giving like music lessons at a school, like traveling house to teach kids and but mainly that's what I've been doing, using that knowledge to apply to business management jobs, I guess, and finance too, like sales and all that. It's something that also has been useful as far as like knowing how to approach people, you know.
How did you get into the music in general and the music that you play and are interested in specifically?
It's funny because like I what I tell everybody is that I feel like a 4 out of 10, just because I met so many great musicians and I see what it takes to like be at the top, and it's like work that I feel like I know how to do it, but yet I'm not putting fully my investment to it. Well, at least in the last recent days and months, I do feel like a little bit more pride of the music I do by meeting all these many other musicians and them saying that, hey, you're good, you wanna play with me here, play with me there, play with me here. So that makes me boost a little bit of my confidence. But in reality, since I come from an academical background, in other words, I know what's to be disciplined and constantly working on the goal that you want to achieve. This could be playing at a theater, this could be winning a competition, which is stuff like I've done a lot. But it all started when I was like probably third grade. Yeah, my parents, both of them have different backgrounds. My mom used to listen to a lot of electronic music when she was younger.
Like
Tiesto, like Eurodance music, you know, like,
really?
Yeah. And my dad would have like he would love rock and classical music a lot. Sometimes they would hear like cumbia, you know, salsa. But my dad, I was privileged that he would take me at such an age to see operas, like at the National Theater. Classical music concerts at least like 3 times, 4 times a year. I don't remember getting bored of it. I remember really enjoying it. So when I was like in third grade, I got into piano lessons until when I was like in sixth grade. Shortly after that, like my piano broke. So I started like doing a lot of sports until like I think it was like probably like seventh grade. I remember seeing my sister go on into a chorus. So I was like, hey, that looks so cool. I saw her perform, you know, and I want to try that too. So I went to the chorus from the church with her. Well, they also did like a lot of like classical music, but like Christian version, I guess, you know, like they changed the lyrics to like Christian words or something, but it was still complex.
Mm-hmm. Was it a Catholic church or?
It was a Baptist church. Yeah. I grew in Catholicism though. Even though I was a Catholic, I would go to the Baptist church, to the church. Yeah.
It was more fun.
The music part, I guess, because every Sunday, I was part of the youth chorus. We wouldn't perform like every Sunday at the church, but the bigger adult chorus, they would always perform on Sundays. So it's actually a little, now I'm getting some flashbacks on how I ended up going to that church. My mom used to take me and my sister, to a Catholic church every Sunday, and she turned to Pentecostal, like evangelical Pentecostal or something, and she brought me and my sister to her church. But me and my sister didn't like that church because first they would be yelling at all times, you know, out loud. My mom would come to the house to yell at us for whatever reason.
What do you mean yelling?
Like, you know, like, yeah, so
the excitement.
Yes, you can call it like that. So we stopped going to church. My dad was like, okay, you know, let's go to my grandparents' church, meaning his dad and mom, because they would travel like 30, 40, maybe an hour, I think, every Sunday to go to that church in Managua City. So that's when we both knew about the chorus and all that, you know. So I was part of that chorus. I was still doing sports because the chorus was only on Saturday. So I did sports every day, like soccer. I was really good at that, actually. I was like in a soccer. I was a sports kid. I play everything. I was in a soccer team.
That's interesting. In this country, there's usually a division mm-hmm. between young people who do sports mm-hmm. and those who do music.
Yeah.
There was no problem for you, like the sports kids didn't mm-hmm. go, you got you know, didn't make fun of you for wanting to sing or play music.
Yeah, no. They actually always admired that for me at very such young age. How I got back into music, because like again there was like a 1-2 year lapse that I was just doing sports, was like, wow, doing sports, we would play until the sun went down, like in the soccer field. So I remember one day one friend was like, hey, I'm going to my guitar lessons, or you want to check it out? It was one of my best friends, and I was like, oh, okay, sure. I would just say yes to anything just to like go out, you know. So I went, and
how old were you then?
I was like 14, 15.
Oh, okay.
So I went to the guitar lessons, and I remember really liking it, you know, like seeing so many guitar. Well, so my teacher, I have such great I admire him so much, because he was a great teacher. Like everybody that was there were playing like either bossa nova, heavy metal. They were playing like all sorts of music, and I was fascinated to a point that I told them, hey, you know, I want to come with you more often, so just let me know when you go to check it out. And by the second, third time, the teacher was like, hey, so I see you coming interested, like you want to learn a little bit, like give it a try. And I'm like, yeah, sure. So I gave it a try. After a month, he was like, okay, it looked like you really liked it, it's time to start paying. So I was like, okay, and I told my dad that I wanted to go to the lessons, so they said, okay. Now, the only problem was that I didn't have a guitar. So my friend, after like a month and a half, he was the one encouraging me to do it, but he got discouraged himself. So we stopped going to the guitar lessons. He lent me his guitar so I could go. Eventually, like after a couple of months, I would say he asked for his guitar back. And I was like wanting to go, so my dad told one of his friends that I was really into guitar, and his friend like say, oh, bring him over. His friends was his name was Tony Ferrari. He was a very popular musician from Nicaragua. He had a band, a rock band, and everything. He was an electric guitar player. So when he saw me and he tried to teach me a little bit, he gave me a guitar. It was I feel so bad for selling that guitar. But like he gave me this Jazz Body Hollow guitar. So for me to start learning how to play, and then I was so excited, man, that I remember practicing like 8 hours a day. I'm not gonna lie. Yeah. Once I had that guitar, I would wake up, play the guitar, shower, play a little bit, breakfast, play a little bit. Then I would go to school, bring it on my lunch break. I would play a little bit. Second lunch break, I would play. After school, I would play. I would have lunch. Maybe I would go play soccer still, like 2-3 hours. But after I would play, then I would go to the guitar lessons. I would play and learn something new. I would get back home, play again. Dinner, play. I would sometimes wake up at 3 a.m. just to play and practice. At some point, my dad had to take the guitar away from me at nighttime because like I was playing so much. I even slept with my guitar inside.
Why do you think that was? What was it that's not a normal reaction that a lot of most kids who play or study music... often there's a point where they don't want to do it anymore. But why do you ever think about why it, like, what did that do for you?
I like that question because, like, I thought about this. And I think it was my teacher's method of, like, teaching. Like, it was not a traditional method because he was, like, a jazz player from the streets that he learned how to play and master music out on the streets. And it was until the last years that he started like studying music theory, but he didn't study that because like he thought it was necessary, but so other musicians wouldn't mock him or say that, oh, you play good, but we put a shit on you and you're nothing, you know. So he learned how to read music by sheet. So, but as something, as like in a status in a way, you know, not necessarily because it was like something that he thought that it was needed to learn how to play. So his method basically was like, you come to the lessons and immediately as you come in, you are learning something. It's not like the usual music lessons, like for example, like classical background where they put the notes in the board and then explain this is C, this is D, you know, and this is a triad and theory and all that. Like I would learn like a song like in 2 weeks after like starting to get the guitar, and I think that was exciting because like the songs I would be learning, they would be like easy songs, but people wouldn't know that, you know, like they see, for example, Oye Como Va, you know, it's two chords, the guitar solo is pentatonic scale all the way, it's super easy. But other people don't know that, you know. So I feel like being able to immediately play something and seeing that the muscle memory aspect of it, of like practicing something more and more and more and more, makes it sound better. I think that's what technically hooked me up on like playing the electric guitar in this sense. But I was only doing that, I would say, like, for a year and a half that I was, like, fully practicing all day, I think.
But that's a critical year and a half.
Yeah.
Especially you're 14 years old.
Yes. They say the same thing, for example, for violin players, that that you have to make it when you're young, because like that's when your body's still forming, that's when you get the right positioning and all that. But I have friends told me that they have taught people that are above 50, above 60. The only thing is that you won't be able to play the hardest songs ever, but you will be able to, like, I guess, a little bit something out of it, you know?
Well, I mean, again, it's what do you want to get out of it?
Yes.
I mean, not, you know, the group that we play with and all different skill levels, but it's just for the fun and the joy and the, you know, of getting together and making music.
Yeah.
And songs. And,
yeah. So after that year and a half, I kind of like cooled it down. I started like getting again more into sports, coming to the music lessons once a month, once every 2 months. After like 7, 8, 9 months that I was like coming and going, not coming, one of the days I went back to the lessons. That's when I remember meeting Emilio, and he had a duo before. Okay, I think that I got like bored.
Is that why?
Yeah, because I was able to do any song I wanted to do, like really hard songs, like heavy metal songs. I would play anything, but I wouldn't have anybody to play it with. You know, I didn't not meet any drummers, any bass players, nothing, because in Nicaragua, or at least for my parents, like, those were savage people, you know, like rock people or like for bums or whatever, even though my dad liked it. But like the earlier stages of that, they like, I wouldn't go to my first rock festival until I was like 17 or something. So when I saw Emilio playing with this other dude, they were playing flamenco. I was playing with backing tracks, that's why I got bored, you know. So when I saw that they were playing together, and unlike the other students too, because the other students would learn like songs to play themselves, but nothing to play with somebody else. When I saw the dynamic of like two people playing together, I was like, wow, I want to do that. So I told my teacher that I wanted to learn flamenco. And he said, okay, but you're not going to do it with an electric guitar. You know, you have to get an acoustic guitar. By then I was... getting a little bit into, I think I was like already in my 11th grade. We only have 11th grade, so over there, there's no 12th grade. So I was about to go to college.
College was, your parents were like, you're going to college.
Yeah.
No question.
I mean, I'm going to get there in a sec. During that time, I did wanted to learn this. So I started like lending guitars again, you know, like nylon string guitars to like get to play with flamenco. Apparently, the Emilio's duo, who he had already a career set up, because Emilio has been learning guitar. He's like 8 years ahead of me. So he already like knew how to play. His partner was living to Canada to study in college or whatever, and my teacher was like, hey, you know, like you should play with Emilio, and you know, his partner's going, you already know one song. Me and Emilio started like practicing, you know, we saw that we got along. So that's when it all started for me, like the momentum again. Like shortly after, 1 month after I started playing with him, we participated in a jazz competition where we got first place, you know. After that jazz competition, social media started talking to us. Media started talking to us. They started, like, hiring us for events, radio interviews, national TV, a bunch of other stuff. Every year, whenever there was something going on, we would get invited. We played for the president over there. Ortega.
Ortega.
Oh. Yeah. It was shortly after that I started doing opera too. Like when I got into college, like on my first year, I became part of the chorus, the opera program, and the music program. The music program was not that good. until the next year. So I was invested a lot into like the classical music again. But at the same time, I was still already like working with Emilio. Like we were the ones that represented my college for music presentations, because we were the ones that were most prepared, you know, to a point that they even allow us to do concerts over there where people would pay to see us. We would have rooms filled of more than 100 people, you know.
And was Emilio at the college too? Or
No. I think he did one year of like engineering, but then he just decided to do music, and that's it, yeah. So I was doing both these two things. I eventually got out of the course because, like, I got bored that I knew everything too, you know. But opera was not like that. I felt the same thing with opera, with the guitar, that the more you practice, the better you can get, the more opportunities you can have. So ever since I've been doing these two things. Well, the opera, I'm kind of like practice by myself, but with Emilio, even after I came to the States, I told him that to never stop practicing the songs, because like we at some point would get together again, and boom, 5 years later, you know, we got together again and started doing music again, and that's how we ended up playing here in New York. When he got his asylum, I told him, hey, you know, if you do get the asylum approved, I'm going to pay your trip so you can come to New York and don't worry about food and rent for when we get something solid or something. And so I did, you know. That's how I brought him here. Well, we stayed like 2 weeks in Miami, 3 weeks to see how it was going to be over there. But then I said, no, let's go to New York, you know.
You prefer New York to Miami?
Yes. For music, yes. Because over there it's more, it's the only high energy music that outstands, meaning like pop, hip hop, reggaeton, salsa, merengue. Like if you do bluegrass or jazz or any other alternative indie in Miami, it's not what people, they're like, ooh, that's boring. Can you play something more happy? You know? It's like, so, but that just never happened here. Actually, I remember what made us decide that it was not going to work over there was that we went to a very fancy restaurant. They wanted to see how we sounded over there. We started playing like Chica de Ipanema, Girl of Ipanema, and the person that was going to hire us, don't you know anything more happy, you know, or more known? I'm like, that's the most known song ever in life, you know? Girl of Ipanema, yeah, you hear her in the elevator even, you know? Like, so we're like, people are not going to appreciate it here. I've met so many amazing, talented musicians that perform $50 for 4 hours or something. Like, people take advantage of, like, musicians that are very dedicated over there. Unless you play, again, like funk or hip-hop, rap, this and that, you know, then over there you can actually make something out of it. But I feel like here music is much more valuable in that sense, because like, we could be playing a very not-known song, but or at least we think it's not known song, but every time we play it, people come to us and say, hey, the song you played, it's so good, you know? Like Chico Ria stuff, Paco de Lucia, and a bunch of other stuff, so that's the main reason that I think I feel like a little bit attached to this place, because like how people value all this, you know, and the time that it takes to like play these hard pieces, because like I'm playing four notes, but I'm there 2 hours playing all those four notes until my memory muscle does say, but I first start like, until I go faster. You know? So, yeah, that's how I basically got where I got with the music, I guess, you know.
you talk a little bit about sort of growing up in Nicaragua? I mean, the United States and Nicaragua have a really old, long history that Americans don't know. Because we just don't know history.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that what you learned in school was a very particular point of view about the United States. And but your father had lived in this country for 20 years and had a different point of view, I'm assuming, of the United States. So was there any sort of dissonance in your education or growing up? You know, I'm hearing this, but then I'm also hearing this at home. Or basically what I'm asking is, what was it like sort of growing up in Nicaragua when you grew up, just in terms of like what you learned, what you knew, what you had to reject, what you accepted?
Well, my parents were always like super, super strict. So, well, with the States particularly, my dad would always be traveling every year to the States to buy stuff like for the house, like clothes, TVs and stuff like that. So it looked like the economy was better in the States. However, when I was like 15 and about to go to college, I told them that I wanted to study music production, which they didn't have that career in Nicaragua. And then said, no, you're crazy. You think you're going to go to the States by yourself. You know, you're going to become a drug addict. You're not going to, you're going to die. You're going to be a criminal. So they have this perception of like things would go really bad if I would come to the States by myself, even if I was living with family, you know. So I would just come to visit. But they said a lot of things too with other careers. And I was like, okay, you know, like, let me, I don't know, then I guess let me do marketing or psychology. And they were like, especially my mom, they were like, oh, no, that's not going to give you any money. You know, like people, psychologists in Nicaragua are always in hunger, you know, like.
The people in Nicaragua are what?
That they're always hungry or in hunger, you know, that it doesn't pay them a lot, in other words,
People are worried about eating. Not their mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. First things first. That makes sense.
So she said, like, you should study law, like your dad. You know, like he can help you out with connections. Yeah, he studied law when he was younger in Nicaragua, but he didn't finish the career. So when I said I was going to study law again, he took studies back, you know, and he became a lawyer. First than me, actually. He did it like in 3 years or 2 years. He was taking like, think like 8 classes or something, and he was really into it because I guess he was excited that I decided to also be a lawyer, so to help me out. And I was like, you know, like I feel like I never make them happy. So I was like, okay, I'll study law. It wasn't until like the second year that I actually started liking it, or like, well, not liking it, but like into it. No, it was actually my junior year, the third year, yeah, because I was doing my internships and I was helping people. I was litigating misdemeanors. I was litigating in the penitentiary system for cases like probation, house arrest, a bunch of other stuff. I never lost a case. I was the best in my internship to a point that they gave me like a small scholarship to go and study with the military over there in Nicaragua, like military law and a bunch of like drug trafficking laws and stuff that they only taught militaries. And so that's when I really, really liked it and said that, damn, like, for example, they had like cases that people would come to me because I was also doing consulting before I would go to litigation and see like if it's an actual misdemeanor or if it's like a felony, because if it's a felony, then I would have to like bring this to a lawyer, you know, because legally I wouldn't be allowed to litigate on felonies unless I had my degree. But that was just enough motivation for me after seeing like a lot of injustice happening in the country. That's when I really put a lot of effort on finishing the career, because I wanted to. It felt good for me being useful, but directly to society, you know, like helping people incriminate bad people or whatever they were doing, or like.
Could you talk about a couple of the cases that are most memorable to you?
Yes, man. I think the one that hit me the most was the one where they had a custody from a kid. Like, their parents were divorced, and the dad was supposed to have the kid for like 2 days or something. So he said, "Oh, I'm gonna take him to the weekend to the beach or something." He had a new wife. They, after that weekend, they stopped communications with the mom, and it was not until like a week after that they got back in communication with her, and they gave the kid back, but the kid had bruises and all. Apparently, what they did at the beach was that they were raping the kid and beating him, like an 8-9-year-old. Yes, so it developed trauma. And the person, the mom, was trying to do something about it, like in her county, but apparently the guy had political affiliation with the government, so they were making the most of not making that case go through. So she came to the city to ask for more help, you know, and it felt really bad, because like, if I would have been a lawyer, I would have taken her case and give the most out of myself, but all I could say is like, I cannot take your case, and we cannot take your case here, because we're only lawyers from the city and not from the county you're coming from, you know. So if, like, again, if I would have been a lawyer, I could just take any case from whichever part in the country, but I wasn't. So cases like that inspired me. I mean, it was a lot of crazy stuff going on too. I had other people coming from psychological damage from their partners, because like, they, I don't know, maybe the guy was like a alcoholic, drunk addict, he beat his wife or something, and then like, he comes to the house, door's locked, he gets a bottle of like whatever, breaks it and starts like opening his wrist, saying, "I'm gonna kill myself if you don't open the door." Another case, like people like showering in gasoline, trying to also say to the woman, like, "I'm gonna kill myself, let me up because of you, if you don't do this and that," you know.
Wow.
So yeah, and I think like the actual worst, really worst case I probably had was something where it was called that I analyzed, I guess, because like, they would take felonies, but I wouldn't be the one in charge. It was like a robbery, assault, rape, and then murder. And the body, they chopped it in parts, put it in the bag, and left it somewhere in like a field. And like in the rural areas in Nicaragua, it gets very savage. There's a lot of savage people over there, you know. And it's always been an issue, you know. Like there's been a lot of laws that are coming often and often about supporting women and this and that, but it has helped. But you know, it's very hard in the rural areas to enforce when you don't have communications over there. So like they don't go to school, like, because they it's not as accessible. They don't have like newspapers or TVs or nothing. So people, I would say, like, they're isolated. When they're isolated, they behave a little bit more primitive, I would say, because they're not being judged or charged for immediately of the things they do. You know, women tend to not go to the cops over there because they're scared that if they go, they're gonna kill them after or something, you know. So those are issues that I studied that they were really bad, and they're still bad, but I guess that they're actually trying to make something better. But again, like, the government right now, it's not law abided, it's political abided, so meaning You could have the best case ever, the proof all you need, and the judge could say no because your nose is too big. And because the judge said it, it's law. And then like they take it to the Supreme Court, the judge is right, that's it, you know? Like there's nothing you can do. So that's why I thought, as most of my friends from college that graduated from law, that it was just worthless trying to be a lawyer over there unless you are taking cases from political affiliated people, you know?
Mm. Yeah. So there was not a... The justice was not blind.
Mm-mm. No.
It was... Mm.
Yeah.
Was it always this way, or did it get worse, or did it just
No,
change?
It got worse. No, yeah, after 2018, it got worse. Yeah. I mean, before that happened, like, there's always been corruption with money and all that, but after 2018, at least, like you said, like, out of, like, the five judges or, like, the seven judges that were, like, in a district, maybe, like, three of those judges or four were, like, really law-abided people, really just people, and they changed them. You know, they took them out. They put political. Same like what's happening here, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Gets worse and worse, yeah. Until the point that, you know, it's you never know what's going to happen because, like, no matter how much you try, it's not up to you as a lawyer and what the Constitution and all the laws say about it, you know? Because the laws over there are very beautiful, very well made. Our system has a lot of similarities with the French model, and a little bit of the Spanish model, same as like most of the countries in Latin America. It's only very few that go with the English model. There's like the three main models, I guess. So I feel like the laws, like, for everything, it's so well made, but it's just the enforcement aspect, you know. That
could you talk a little bit about the differences? I mean, that's interesting. In this country, we're on the English model.
Yeah.
Except for Louisiana, which is on the Napoleonic Codes.
Yeah, but yeah. Well, the reason that we have those models was basically for the La Conquista, you know, like Spanish people came in, so basically we had all these. Mainly Spanish, but also a little bit of French model when it comes to like civil law, because all the constitutions from all the countries from Latin America are mainly like copycat, you know, and a lot of laws are, they started being like that, like they just transcribed the like, for example, Nicaragua, the first civil code was literally the same as the one in France, you know. And eventually, like, they started, like, changing, like, words and like, statement, because maybe they talked about whoever steals binds off a particular food from France, you know, it's going to get this time in jail or whatever. And in Nicaragua, we didn't have those fruits or whatever, so that's why they actually had to change it to, like, make it more appealing to our country. And same thing they did with all the countries in Latin America that they all copy a model from certain constitution, and eventually they did their own, but after copying the ones that already existed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what would be the difference just between sort of the French or the Spanish model and the English model?
I would say the theoretical aspect, it's pretty much the same. Maybe the procedures, how procedures run, because let's just say like in a labor case, for example, let's do criminal, like in a criminal case, like the stages, it could be like a mediation, then the initial phase where they talk about what are you being judged. And then that's when it changes. Like sometimes some models have the testimonies first, you know, and then they have like a session review for the proof, but other models might have the proof, the validation of fighting for the proof, what's allowed or not first, and they leave the testimonials to the very end, you know. So it's just the process and how they. The structure of the of the of the court cases, how I developed the procedures, yeah.
So, and just one more quick question on this. So, I mean, just philosophically, we are supposed to operate on the principle of innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's the same.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's the same. The only.
But again, you could have the best system in the world.
Mm-hmm.
If you fill it with rotten people, it's going to stink.
Yes. Like another one of those debatable topics that I think it's only in the States and not in a lot of countries, or like a minority of countries, like the death penalty.
Mm.
Like most of the lawyers around the world agree that it shouldn't be a thing, because the principle criminally that all the countries tend to agree as far as like what is the whole point of having a legal procedure or a criminal procedure, for example, it would be that the suspect that did an atypical act to the society, it's getting treatment so they can be reinserted again in society.
Yeah.
You know. So in other words, they believe that people can change, because there's more than proof that people can change. You know, you never know, somebody maybe murder someone and then like now, but they regret it. They read the Bible every day. They assist in church. They do community service.
The Bible every day. I have I had a guest twice on this show, Hector, remarkable man. The first time I interviewed him, he was in prison, and he was in for murder, and but he was 18.
Mm-hmm.
19, he was a Dominican.
Yeah.
Or from his parents. You know, mm-hmm. And he, in prison, found art.
Mm-hmm.
And became an artist. And at the age, he spent 30 years of his life in prison. He got out and, most of his adult life, all of his adult life up until that point, was in prison. And he came out and he... religion, art, something to live for, and help them out. Yeah, I agree 100%.
Yeah, and
the people can change, you know, if they are given an opportunity.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And you taking somebody's life, there's no opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when you were confronted sort of with how the United States worked, but you had been coming and visiting family here for years, right?
Yeah.
How did you reconcile, or how did you? I was like, oh, this country has all these wonderful things,
mm-hmm.
but there's also some pretty dark things about this country.
Well, similar to what was happening in Nicaragua, like at the beginning, what's politically happened. It's not affecting the other areas of law, like civil, the environment, labor, family. So you get like in the bubble, I guess. Like people are minding their own business because like what's happening politically is not affecting them until it does, you know. So I feel like, or at least what I feel from this country is that it gives me a vibe of like the early stages of what was happening in Nicaragua, that you could be a lawyer, you could put the bad guys in prison still, until you can't, until like it starts getting too political, and no matter what you do, you are not gonna be able, you're gonna get stuck at some point, no matter what you do in life, because like what ends up affecting directly, or who ends up getting affected directly, is the population, not even the people that are making these choices, And we have seen this happening from very long times, that like people, it's older people making all these decisions that's affecting the younger people, and it's the younger people that starts making like intentions of like revolution initiatives, of revolution and doing all this stuff, because like there's a point until people say no more. And I'm happy that that actually happened in Nicaragua, that everybody knew that Arnoldo Lehmann was like a corrupt dude, because like the only reason he's out, it was because our criminal code was having a single article to accuse money laundering with drug trafficking. So since he didn't commit both, and you have to fulfill the whole article to be judged by that, he didn't get judged for his money laundering. And that's when he left Ortega, and we all knew that it was bad, but nothing was really changing at all, you know, for daily lives and people.
For listeners, who are you talking about?
Arnoldo Lehmann was the previous president before Daniel Ortega.
And what party was he from?
I think he was political party. It was called PLC, Partido Liberal something, yeah. He basically modified the laws and everything so Ortega could come back. And ever since he didn't leave, you know. And again, like in 2018, ever since that moment to 2018, people already know that he was shady and that they were making a lot of illegal stuff, but it wasn't affecting them directly. And that's why in 2018, there was like millions and millions of people out of their houses protesting, because they all said like, oh, so you came out. We all agree that he's a nasty dude that doesn't deserve to be here. Let's get together, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people do have the power. So what he did, Ortega, was that he started releasing inmates from prison without no legal procedure. So they would start like giving them guns and money so they could like start shooting people that were protesting. And I think it was like at least like 600 people, 800 people that died in the first week or two.
That's amazing. There was almost no...
It was like a genocide.
There's almost no coverage of that
in
this country.
No, because all the people that... I mean, they did cover it, but what happened was that all the people, ever since that time, all the people that were with cameras